clear exposition, so I appreciate that very much. That was a great introduction to our day. And second, we have Andrew Shepherd, who is one of the co-directors of Arosha. Andrew is has someone who has facilitated learning for Christians and non-Christians for the last 20 years in theology, in ethics, in environmental studies, but also especially through being able to lead young people in a very deep dive experiential understanding of some of these issues, which I actually think, Andrew, is probably just an excuse to climb mountains and go down rivers, but it's been very, very, very effective. He also, do you want to come out so I can see you now? Yeah, so I can sort of speak at you rather than behind. Andrew is also has a number of roles teaching and researching, including for the Centre of Theology and Public Issues at the University of Otago. And he lives with his family in Makarora. Anyone heard of Makarora? Anyone not heard of Makarora? Wow, that's amazing. It's about 60 k's north of Wanaka, on just towards the Haas Pass. And he has loads of people. How many people have stayed with Andrew over the years? Yeah, quite a few. He has lots of people wandering through. So welcome, Andrew. Thanks.
Just before I begin, actually, there are still some people standing at the back and a little bit short of seats, so this is kind of like a church service. Maybe, you know, if you come to the front, you'll get the maximum blessings, and we can turn this into some sort of prosperity doctrine church, and I can bless you enormously. That was a joke.
I'll
set up
the anxious
bench. Yeah, thanks, Derek. Nana nei nā mea katoa. Ko te mea tua rua e mihi ki te tangata whenua nei. E te papa, te nā koe. E te whare karakia, St. John's, te nā koe. E ngā mana whenua te Whanganui a Tara. Tēnā koutou. Ko te mea tua rua, tua toru e mihi ki ngā whānau, Arosha, NZCIS, Manuhiri, tēnā koutou katoa. I'm the second plenary here, and I don't have a PowerPoint for you, but I want to frame the discussion around the title of Facing Fear, Harnessing Hope. And so this is an old-fashioned. I was talking to someone from Arosha last night who informed me that she was an oral learner. So for those of you who are oral learners, this is good because you're not going to have a video to stare at. In June this year, the cover story for the influential New York magazine caused something of a stir. The article entitled The Uninhabitable Earth, written by US journalist David Wallace Wells, painted a bleak doomsday picture of the worst-case scenario the world faces if we fail to take large-scale immediate action on climate change. Wallace Wells offered a vivid and frightening vision of the future, one of killer heat waves, crippling famine, economic collapse, plagues, and resource wars. Wallace Wells' apocalyptic rendering of the future, which has now had over 2 million views, was met with a range of reactions from those engaged in the arena of climate change advocacy and mobilisations. Some, such as Susan Matthews writing in Slate, believed that, quote, this instantly viral piece might be the silent spring of our time, and alluding here to Silent Spring by Rachel Carson in the 1960s. However, others took umbrage both at what they perceived as the scientific errors present in Wallace Wells' argument, which it was ultimately determined were actually quite minor, and more significantly at the overall tone of Wallace Wells' piece. In a blog post on Medium, Daniel Cohen, an assistant sociology professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who works in climate politics, called the piece, quote, climate disaster porn. Meanwhile, Eric Holtis summed up the critique of many in his response on an online magazine, Grist, which was entitled, quote, stop scaring people about climate change. It doesn't work. Of course, this raises a number of questions. Is there a place for doomsday apocalyptic visions in environmental and climate change communication? does the emotion of fear automatically lead to inaction? And what is the relationship between fear and hope-filled action? To answer these questions, it requires at least initially a foray into the contested and rapidly developing world of human psychology, and in particular the exploration of how what we're learning about the human brain is shaping the PR and the communications arena. The founders of modern evolutionary psychology, a husband and wife couple, Leda Cosmides and John Tooby, argue that there are two parts of our brain that are critical to information processing. The cortex and the posterior parietal cortex, which are analytical and logical and encode in words, symbols and numbers, and the amygdala, the emotional seat of our brain, which responds to intuition and experience and encodes in images. Other evolutionary psychologists such as Daniel Gilbert and Daniel Kahneman believe that one of the main reasons we have thus far struggled to address the issue of climate change is due to the way in which our brains have evolved. Gilbert argues that over millennia, the brains of Homo sapiens have evolved to respond to issues or threats that are personal, abrupt, immoral, now. The acronym there, personal, abrupt, immoral, now. Pain. Accordingly, according to these theorists, our evolutionary history has gifted us with brains which are ill-equipped to deal with threats that are universal, long-term, stem from morally ambiguous actions, and in which the consequences lie far off in the future. These same evolutionary psychologists argue that critical, therefore, to overcoming this inaction is the role of emotion. In contrast to much climate change and environmental stories, which are scientifically driven and rely heavily on analytical facts and figures, Kahneman contends that to mobilise people, this has to become an emotional issue. It has to have immediacy and salience. The psychologists who stress the importance of emotion as a behaviour driver note that fear is an instinctual human reaction, an evolutionary trait that has developed over the millennia of human existence. Fear leads to a surge of adrenaline, and it is this fight or flight response, they argue, which is essential to human actions in the face of threats. In a 2006 paper, Kristen Passon and Meeta Shwarjan argue that the emotions of fear and guilt are more powerful motivators for human behavioural change than positive, hopeful or feel-good messages. In contrast to this thinking, other psychological studies argue that fear is counterproductive and that rather than motivating change behaviour, the emotion of fear can lead to a paralysis of action. Authors of an influential 2009 study concluded that their research had shown that, quote, dramatic, sensational, fearful, shocking, and other climate change representations of a similar ilk, while they can successfully capture people's attention to the issue of climate change, are also likely to disengage or distance individuals from climate change issues. Responding specifically to the question of apocalyptic doomsday imagery, these researchers concluded that while these images certainly have a place, they need to be paired with other appeals, and that viewers of these images need to have feasible coping responses, they need to have high self-efficacy and the ability to respond behaviourally in order that barriers to engagement are not encountered. So much for the psychology or the ongoing debate there. Of course, underlying this conversation is the place and the role of communication environmental messages, and in particular the relationship between facts and figures and narratives. Last month, where I live is very remote, and last month I was in a city, and so I got to see Al Gore's An Inconvenient Sequel. Who's seen An Inconvenient Sequel? A few of you. And while, you know, appreciative of the immense work that Al Gore has done in climate change advocacy, I was struck again as I watched this movie, similar to the predecessor in Inconvenient Truth, A Decade, the extent to which the movie relied on raw scientific data and economic analysis to make its point. And yet, as climate change communications consultant George Marshall notes, quote, stories perform a fundamental cognitive function. They are the means by which the emotional brain makes sense of the information collected by the rational brain. People may hold information in the form of data and figures, but their beliefs about it are held entirely in the form of stories. Marshall expresses grave concern at the nature of climate change communication, making what I believe are two important observations. Firstly, he notes that rational scientific data will usually lose against a compelling emotional story that speaks to people's core values. A really obvious example you might want to think about of this is, for instance, the issue of 1080 in New Zealand. Department of Conservation, I see someone from there in the back corner, you know, will give all the scientific data about 1080, but ultimately if you are arguing against people whose core instinctual value system is, I don't want 1080 on the land near me, then you're not going to win that argument. Secondly, George Marshall also takes issue with the enemy narrative template that shapes much of the communication in the environmental movement. Marshall argues that we need to move beyond battleground narratives, i.e. environmentalists versus fossil fuel industry, and instead create a quest narrative focused around a shared vision. Marshall argues that the fossil fuel industry is not the enemy, but rather simply one of the obstacles that stands in the way of making the necessary changes. The real battle for mass action, Marshall writes, will not be won through enemy narratives, but rather we need to find narratives based on cooperation, mutual interest, and our common humanity. For Marshall, the real story, quote, is not about scapegoating an enemy, but about our fear, denial, and struggle to accept our own responsibilities. While Marshall does not share Christian faith, ultimately he, along with many others in the environmental movement, are finding something increasingly compelling in faith narratives. Marshall writes in his book, "What makes religious belief so relevant to climate change conviction is that both struggle against the same cognitive obstacles. Climate change is extremely challenging because it requires people to accept that something is true solely because of the authority of the communicator. It manifests in events that are distant in time and places, and it challenges our normal experiences and our assumptions about the world. Above all, climate change requires people to endure certain short-term losses in order to avoid uncertain long-term costs." So what might the Christian faith offer to this discussion? In what follows, I want to suggest that the Christian scriptures and the tradition of which they are embedded, we see in them narratives of doomsday and triumph, emotions of fear and hope, and that in these narratives, rather than being seen as mutually exclusive, they accompany each other and work together to shape the human imagination and thus to mobilise people for action. And so having discussed sort of psychology and PR, human communications, for some of you I'll move to an obscure area, and for others of you, you'll feel much more comfortable sort of as I move to a biblical reflection here. Within the Christian scriptures, there are numerous passages, especially within the writings of the prophets and the gospels, that offer doomsday visions of the future. The structural resonance between climate change apocalypticism and Christian faith is very evident, as Marshall has just noted. And even more so if one looks at the Olivet discourses in the Synoptic Gospels, which is the period where Jesus is speaking in the Mount of Olives with his disciples. These discourses in Matthew 24 are preceded in chapter 23 by Jesus' strident critique of the teachers of the law and the Pharisees. Jesus angrily denounces these community leaders, accusing them of hypocrisy and blindness. His critique of these leaders is summed up in the statement, quote, "For you tithe mint, dill, and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith." It is perhaps, I would suggest, not too far a stretch of the imagination to imagine Jesus speaking in our modern day context. "Oh, you blind politicians, you run election campaigns calling us to secure our future while continuing to hold on to the mantra of limitless growth. You travel to global forums on climate change while creating loopholes for your country's greatest polluters to walk through. You speak of the knowledge of a knowledge economy, speak of the importance of a knowledge economy and of diversification, and yet pour millions of dollars into irrigation to grow an industry which, while bringing financial wealth, is ecologically unsustainable. You promote New Zealand's clean green image internationally while seemingly ignoring the fact that current levels of conservation funding will lead to the inevitable loss of endemic species, taonga that have existed in Aotearoa for millennia." And yet Jesus' passionate words against the community leaders of his day, his damning censures, do not degenerate into an enemy narrative. The hypocrisy and blindness of these leaders is to be denounced and named for what it is, but it is also primarily one to be lamented. Thus Jesus concludes this passage by saying, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, how often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. See, your house is left desolate." Turning from his rebuke of the community leaders, Jesus then offers a powerful doomsday vision of the future. Chapter 24. Jesus begins by alluding to the destruction of the temple, verses 1 to 2. Mentions war, famines, and natural disasters, verses 6 to 8. Speaks of the torturing persecution of prophets, betrayal, and false prophets who will arrive, verses 9 to 14. And then returns once again to the most important identifying symbol for first century Jews, the temple, predicting its desecration. Jesus' imagery of destruction and terror here is not about scaring people to death, but rather is, by its very nature, apocalyptic. The word apocalyptic in Greek means to uncover, to lay bare. And here, as with the young boy in Hans Christian Andersen's tale, The Emperor's New Clothes, Jesus here is engaged in truth-telling, exposing the reality of the way the world really is. The people of Yahweh, captured by a nationalistic, exclusivist messianism, have lost sight of their calling to be a light to the nations. The invitation to create a society of justice and peace has been replaced by a highly hierarchical and stratified society in which inequality is perceived as inevitable. A society where the silencing of prophetic voices who point to an alternative future ensures the maintenance of the status quo. Jesus' warning is stark to his listeners. Such a society, founded upon structural violence, will eventually succumb to violence. The days of the rebuilt temple, the symbol of identity, are numbered. As in Israel's earlier history, the failure to live out the vision of a just society to be a kingdom of God's justice and mercy will mean collapse. And Jonathan's already alluded to Jared Diamond's important book, Collapse. So too, in our time, climate scientists and ecologists operate as reluctant prophets, their scientific data providing an apocalyptic unveiling of the true reality of the world. For two centuries, we have kidded ourselves that we can master nature. Yet as with previous civilizations, we are now discovering that our abuse has consequences and that the human mastery of nature is a fantasy. There are some important elucidating remarks to make with regard to Jesus' apocalyptic discourse. Firstly, Jesus' doomsday discourse is not a divine oracle pointing to a predestined future, but rather is the voice of a prophet announcing the consequences that await a maintenance of the status quo. Secondly, Jesus' truth-telling, like all the stories of voices of prophets, is not an end in and of itself. Rather, his unveiling of the way the things really are is a summons to repentance. And as Christian ethicist Timothy Gorringe notes, the call to repentance is always a call to action. Earlier I noted how psychologists suggested that messages which may evoke fear should be utilised with those who have high self-efficacy and the ability to respond. And this structure is clearly evident in these biblical passages. While Jesus' apocalyptic imagery undoubtedly would have evoked emotions of guilt and fear amongst his listeners, he does not expect his listeners to lapse into fatalism and apathy. And as the passage continues in the rest of it, you see that Jesus stresses to his followers the need for vigilance, preparedness, faithfulness, that is setting about to do the work of the kingdom. And so the parables of the faithful and unfaithful servant, the 10 bridesmaids, the parable of the talents, all of them are about planting seeds of the kingdom and being faithful. And critically, at the end of chapter 25 is the well-known passage where he also instructs his followers to care for the most vulnerable. The passage about caring, the drink of water, visiting those in prison, water for those who are thirsty. Jesus' doomsday rendering of the future, therefore, is not designed to induce paralysing terror, but rather is about calling his listeners to attention to all that is at risk, awakening the society he is embedded in to the losses that will continue if they follow down the path they are on. Jesus' apocalyptic message is tied to a renewed call to action and faithfulness here in the present. The third elucidating remark, and most significantly, the summons to action issued by Jesus to his disciples and to those continuing in the Christian tradition today is predicated upon a broader vision of a distinct future. In Matthew's Sermon on the Mount in chapter 5, Jesus expands and universalises the law of Moses given originally at Sinai. And here in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus does not offer a new sort of to-do set of micro-actions or policy formulations, but rather he offers a broad sweeping vision of a new society, a visionary manifesto designed to capture people's imagination. And it is here, arguably, that the Christian tradition has the potential to most offer something to broader society as we look to the question around the future of creation. Arguably, one of the greatest challenges that modern-day environmental movement has faced is its failure to capture a broad, compelling vision that captures our imagination. Hope is critically tied to imagination. Yet we live in an age where the dominant narrative of global techno-capitalism seems to have emasculated our imaginations. Contemporary politics is shaped by what I would call the pragmatism of the possible. No longer in politics do we get sweeping visions about radically different futures, but rather we are offered variations on the theme which exists within the parameters of the socio-political, economic, neoliberal paradigm. That our vision is determined not by an aspirational impossible future, but by the constraints of present possibilities is perhaps most striking with regard to the issue of water quality and land use here in Aotearoa. For example, a recent ECAN report delivered to the government regarding New Zealand's fifth largest lake, Lake Ellesmere, noted that nearly every dairy farm in the Selwyn district would need to be shut down for this polluted lake to meet the new national water quality standards. In suitably doomsday rhetoric, the report noted that the resulting $300 million annual loss in the district's operating surplus would fundamentally change its economic and social fabric, leading to a reduction in employment, depopulation and bankruptcies. The report noted, quote, that such large-scale effective retirement of intensive land has not been experienced in New Zealand on any scale, and the implications would be far-reaching. End quote. Indeed so. It's also important to note that this large-scale shift of dairying on this landscape has also taken place over an exceptionally short period of time, the last two decades. And so this is an example of the tyranny of the pragmatism of the possible, which allows us, therefore, to, instead of offering an aspiring vision of swimmable rivers, to simply redefine what we mean by swimmable. And yet, in contrast to this pragmatism of the possible, the Christian tradition and other messianic religions offer a different way of contrasting and conceiving the future. The Christian hope is not confined to what is possible, but rather is predicated upon the impossible, that is, the resurrection of Christ from the dead. The summons to action issued by the prophets in the Hebrew scriptures, by Jesus to his disciples, and to those continuing in the tradition, is established not upon the potential success of our actions, but rather on the faithfulness of God. As Vaclav Havel, the poet, playwright and first president of the Czech Republic, so poignantly puts it, and here's a long quote which is worth reflecting on. The kind of hope I often think about, I understand above all as a state of mind, not a state of the world. Either we have hope within us or we don't. It is a dimension of the soul, and it's not essentially dependent on some particular observation of the world or estimate of the situation. It is an orientation of the spirit and of the heart. It transcends a world that is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond these horizons. Hope in this deep and powerful sense is not the same as joy that things are going well, or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously headed for early success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good. Not just because it stands a chance to succeed. The more unpropitious the situation in which we demonstrate hope, the deeper that hope is. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. The contemporary loss of vision, which I reflected on, was apparent too, I would suggest, in our latest election campaign. While there was much talk about values, there was little vision casting about an alternative future. And yet the problem with language and discussion around values is that this assumes that there are universally held and shared values, which of course is oxymoronic, because otherwise we wouldn't have a range of political parties. For those of us, particularly in those in the room, which I would, my guess would be a number of you, involved in, say, the environmental movement, the problem with reducing environmental care or climate change issues to a value is that we run the risk of speaking only to those who share our values. In contrast to this value approach, what happens if we paint a vision that is broad enough and compelling enough to be interpreted and embraced by groups according to their existing values? Such vision casting can operate at both a micro and a macro level. And so I want to end by giving you a couple of illustrations around that. The first would be on a micro level and the story of Arosha here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and in particular our major project which takes place up in Whangaroa Raglan. The Karioi project was birthed essentially out of a blame game and out of enemy narratives. The enemy was DOC and authorities who wanted to dump 1080 on the mountain. And the good guys were those who wanted to stop the bad guys dumping 1080 onto that mountain. A broader vision of what does it mean to create a restored Seabird Mountain enables ultimately the whole community to buy into that, but to buy into it with the values that they already hold. local hapu therefore can be involved because they are able to enact their value of enacting mana whenua on their mountain. Local businesses can be involved because they can enact on their value, which is increasing opportunities for ecotourism and therefore business growth. Farmers can act on their value, which is that they want better farming outcomes and therefore they'll be involved in predator control and allow predator control because that will lower predators and possums around the fringes of their farms. Local residents are empowered because their value is that they want to play a role in land management in their area. Environmentalists value restored ecosystems. They can be involved in that vision. And recreationalists, they want a playground, and their value is to find ways that they can run around and enjoy. And again, they can involve in that vision because the vision is broad enough that everybody can bring their set of values to play. Likewise, a broader national vision. You might think here of predator-free New Zealand or carbon zero New Zealand. Broad, encompassing visions which allow other people to enter into them. Both of those visions encourage business entrepreneurs and innovators to be involved because there are opportunities to be involved in wealth creation and new opportunities for businesses. Environmentalists can bring their values because they're speaking about restored ecosystems and the protection of endemic species. The vision there of carbon zero will inspire architects and planners involved in who have a vision of green cities, and with Steve Muir in the room, and people who are passionate, their value is about transportation and cycle friendly and less pollution, can likewise engage in that vision. Thinking at a grassroots or a medium level in our congregations, the vision of a temple garden can involve those who are interested in looking after their churches because they can be more sustainable, which, who's a deacon here? Someone will be a deacon or a manager at a church wanting to lower, or probably the accountant who's thinking, how do I save some money here? They can be involved. Their value is, how do I save money? Those interested in community outreach within their churches, the evangelists, the mission-minded, can immediately bring their values and their way they're wired. And those interested in creative expressions of worship can be connected, and those interested in hospitality. And so I want to suggest that the faith communities and Indigenous communities in New Zealand, with long histories and motifs to draw upon, have a critical role in shaping such broad visions of the future. These visions will need to move past scientific data, facts and figures, and economic analysis. And this leads, therefore, to a final, very practical question. How does one communicate such a broad vision that fires our imagination, the cognitive part of us, that fills us with hope, that is, that connects with our emotions, and yet also mobilises us for action? And here I want to suggest that one of the missing things within the environmental movement is songs. You see, we seem to have a problem with communication in the environmental movement. We either have the scientific world or the secular world, if you want to use that language, which depends on scientific data and economical analysis. The Christian world, which offers either decontextualised biblical imperatives or a set of to-do lists. And yet, within our tradition, within the Christian tradition, songs have played a critical role in terms of shaping our imaginations. Obviously, the role of the Psalms throughout the Christian history of the church, or, particularly poignant this weekend, the Canticle of the Creatures by St. Francis in terms of the way in which that shapes his imagination. The importance of waiata for Māori in terms of shaping the way in which they think and view the world. Murray has already made this comment that there's no coincidence that all major social movements of the last arguably 300 years have been sustained and shaped by music. Anti-slavery campaign, the song Amazing Grace. US slavery, John Brown's body lies a mouldering in the grave, get off the track in northern states, or down on the plantations, go down Moses. Civil rights, we shall overcome. Vietnam War, ain't gonna start a war no more. Ain't gonna start a war no more. Anti-apartheid. Nicole Sekeli Africa within Africa. And to an international audience, give me hope, Joanna, give me hope. Joanna, written about Johannesburg. Or probably more popular, Free Nelson Mandela. Global socialism. The Internationale. global environmental climate change movement. I've got written down here, Joni Mitchell, big yellow taxi. You paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Anyone got any suggestions about a song that grabs us and moves us?
5 years ago, there was a group of 750 young people in Auckland who flashed off with a song by Swedish House Mafia, Save the World Tonight.
Cool. Great. I'll grab the connection for that. Yeah, I'd love to see it. It's obviously not something that we know, though, that has grabbed us like those other songs. And so maybe that's one way that we might want to think about framing visions, about the role that songs play in shaping broader movements. In conclusion, I began by noting the critique of Wallace Weld's article and the observance from some that the modern-day environmental movement needs to focus not on fear, but on telling positive stories. I have suggested that doomsday narratives, rather than being avoided, are a necessary aspect of revealing the reality of the world that we live in. But to face fear and harness hope and mobilise people to care for creation, we need not more scientific facts and figures, but compelling narratives that engage our emotions. These narratives need to, one, move beyond enemy narratives or beyond blame. Two, they need to be encompassing visions that make space for a diverse range of people with different values. Three, we need to move beyond the pragmatism of the possible and instead offer aspirational visions. Four, we need to embrace the voices of spirituality and Indigenous thinking. And five, we need to express those visions creatively. Thank you. I was wondering why you're pointing me. Amanda, are you going to sing to me? You're going to offer me an environmental song?
Kia ora tātou, Amanda from Rotorua. I'm just interested in your statement about moving beyond, what was the word you used, enemy narratives with regard to fossil fuel companies. And I'd like to disagree with what you said, because I think when it comes to things like fossil fuels, and particularly the fossil fuel industry, whilst we as communities may need new narratives, I think there is a place for, maybe enemy is not the right word, but we need to, basically, this is what's driving our crisis. Obviously there are bigger ways about the way we live that drive that, but we have so little time to turn this around. I'd like to suggest the divestment movement is our best chance, and it basically means not funding these enterprises anymore. So I would just like to put that out there, and just noting with slavery as well, I think the narrative there about getting rid of slavery couldn't really embrace slavery as part of a solution.
But the critical difference here, that's a strategy question. So the issue is not saying, I'm a big fan of divestment. And that's important, but that's a strategy. The question here around enemy narratives is the way in which we look at the world. And so if the argument is, well, we're over here and you're the bad guys over there and we're going to defeat you, then it's a very difficult way for us globally, both nationally, small communities, but also globally, to move forward, because the language is us and them.
I'll disagree, but I'll leave that to someone else.
Steve.
Just following on from that, Z Energy is quite an interesting example in New Zealand. So if you look at Z Energy's sustainability page, they're very strong in saying, we're an energy company, we're selling you petrol at the moment because that's what you want, but we're quite happy to sell you electricity if that's what you choose to switch to. So they're trying to, switch from the enemy. They're not opposing electrification of private motor cars, are saying. So, yeah, it's just being run the enemy narrative. We are the ones who are buying the petrol. If we choose not to, they're quite happy to switch. So they're trying to play that. Whether that's greenwash or whether that's genuine change will remain to be seen. Hopefully it is genuine change.
The enemy narrative is linked to the idea of a broader vision, because as long as you're in the enemy narrative, then you presuppose that the only way we're going to move forward is as everybody comes and joins your value group, and as opposed to the idea of how do you take others on a broader vision. So I'm not applauding the fossil fuel industry or not denying the fact that what's in the ground has to stay in the ground, but I'm just saying that the way in which we shape our narratives has to rethink that language, that if we defeat the fossil fuel industry, then therefore everything's going to work out all right. Because actually, as George Marshall would say, that's simply one obstacle that we have to overcome, or multiple obstacles that we have to overcome. Yeah, sorry, Colin.
Is, in fact, picking up on that, and that broader notion that, you know, we leave things to the market. Ultimately, the market is us. That previous comment, you know, the fuel company energy will change when we stop buying fuel. So actually, it's our decisions, it's what we do as individuals, that shapes the market, that shapes what we get. So actually, it's all down to us.
Yes, but also our decisions and our choices are limited by the nature of the way the market works. And so, you know, the argument that it's purely up to consumer choice, yes, we have power as consumers, but those choices that we have are also limited by questions around the setup of socio-political realities. One more question. Helen. Sorry, Paul.
Me?
Yeah.
Thank you. And related to that is the invisible structures, including the money system. And so the money system that we have demands growth, or we have other problems if we're not growing. And so we look, and today, Nicole and myself in our workshops will be looking at what you might say the big picture, the structures, and what you might call the DNA of the money system itself. Mm. Not what we do with money, but how it is created, for whose benefit, and what outcomes.
So there's a plug to Helen's, and I've also given you a plug to go to Crystal's if you want to think about how you cast a bigger vision. But there's also a whole bunch of other really great workshops, so you can fight amongst yourselves without creating an enemy. You can work out which friend you would like to go to which workshop.
Thank you, Andrew. Thanks for reminding us of the need for hope, and also for stories of engaging values, and also especially for just a reminder of the need for song and engaging emotions, and taking seriously our cultural evolution that really does draw on the role of story and requires us not to just be here, but to be here as well. Because the future really does belong to those with the most compelling stories. So thanks so much.